Okay, good morning. The topic I wanted to speak about today are the tefillos that come towards the end of the Shabbos morning davening, specifically Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores, which is recited immediately after Ein Kel Okeinu. And part of what we'll talk about today is whether there is an intrinsic connection between Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores. Let's just try to understand a little bit more about what both of those tefillos are expressing, where they come from, and to try to understand them a little bit more deeply. There seem to be two distinct approaches in the classic commentaries to understand why it is that we say Ein Kel Okeinu at the end of Shabbos davening. So first of all, we should just note the following. There's a significant difference between Nusach Ashkenaz outside of Eretz Yisrael versus Nusach Ashkenaz within Eretz Yisrael, as well as Nusach Sfarad. Right, the classic Nusach Ashkenaz approach to Ein Kel Okeinu and to Pitum HaKetores is to only say it on Shabbos at the end of davening. In contrast, if one goes today to Eretz Yisrael, even if one davens in a Nusach Ashkenaz shul, so the custom in Eretz Yisrael is to recite Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores every single day at the end of davening, but even for those who daven Nusach Ashkenaz. Additionally, those who daven Nusach Sfarad recite Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores at the end of davening every single day, both in Eretz Yisrael as well as outside of Eretz Yisrael. So part of what we're going to try to understand today is where that distinction comes from. You know, why is it that the classic non-Eretz Yisrael Nusach Ashkenaz restricts Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores to being a Shabbos tefila? And why is it that these other customs, you know, Nusach Ashkenaz and Eretz Yisrael, as well as Nusach Sfarad generally, extend the recitation of Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKetores to the weekdays as well? The earliest reference we find to the tefillah of Ein Kel Okeinu is in the writings of the early Rishonim. It's mentioned already in a Siddur that's attributed to Rashi. And commenting in the early Middle Ages, the commentary of the Kolbo writes that the purpose of Ein Kel Okeinu is to make up the missing brachos which ordinarily we would be making on Shabbos. We know that there's a concept that the Gemara relates to David HaMelech, that David HaMelech instituted an idea that one is supposed to try to recite 100 brachos every single day. And while that's a beautiful idea, and on a typical weekday, you know, just going about your regular business, you actually manage to do it. I mean, if you daven all the things you're supposed to daven, if you, you know, eat all the meals you're supposed to eat, you end up making 100 brachos. However, Shabbos is a little bit more challenging, because whereas during the week, the regular Shmoneh Esrei is either 18 or 19 brachos, on Shabbos it's 7. So right off the bat, you know, you're missing 11 or 12 brachos, you know, 3 times over in the course of a regular Shmoneh Esrei. So, you know, how do we address this idea of making 100 brachos, being the fact that, the liturgy itself seems to be stacked against us? So the Kolbo writes that Yesh Mekomo Shenagu Lomar Ein Kel Okeinu Achar Tefilas Musaf. There are places where they have the practice of saying Ein Kel Okeinu after Musaf on Shabbos and Yom Tov. No, you know, he doesn't say that it's a universal practice. It's, there are places that do it. And the idea is to round out, to make sure that we have the requisite number of 100 brachos recited every day. Because you are only davening 7 brachos in Shmoneh Esrei, as opposed to 18 or 19 brachos, right? So it ends up that you're missing 11 brachos per Shmoneh Esrei, that's 3 times Shmoneh Esrei. So you're missing, in his count, 33 brachos. Now, if you're paying careful attention over here, I'm not good at math, so I got lost already, that's why I have to read it out of the text. But he's assuming, the Kolbo is assuming, what's that? Oh, one second, we'll get the most of it. Chabal is assuming that a regular weekday Shemoneh Esrei only has 18 brachas. This is not true, right? We have 19 brachas in a Shemoneh Esrei, right? So again, if you follow his math for a minute, he's assuming that the differential between a weekday Shemoneh Esrei and a Shabbos Shemoneh Esrei is going to be 11 brachas times 3 is 33, right? But that's not actually true. The differential is actually 12, right? So times 3 is actually 36. So hold that thought in the back of your head. He seems to be working with an 18 brachas Shemoneh Esrei. We'll come back to that in a minute. In any case, on a typical Shabbos, you're down 33. In other words, you know, here you are, 33 brachas short of the 100 count. So how do you make it up? Okay, so fortunately, daven mukha. So that's 7 right there. We also have an extra meal on Shabbos. But normally the assumption was that you'd only be eating twice during the course of the day. So you have now on Shabbos an extra meal. So how many brachos does the extra meal give you? Well, you wash, you have Nesilas Yadayim, you have Hamotzi, and then you have the 4 brachos of Birkas Hamazon. So that gives you another 6. Okay, so already we were down 33. But now we're up 13, if you're following this. Next time I'll give the shiur, I'll give you a smartboard, right?
But Leil
Shabbat
count?
Yeah, Leil Shabbat would count. So in other words, we're counting from, you know, from Leil Shabbat to the end of Shabbat, right? So there, so now we're short 20, if you're following this, right? In other words, we were down 33, but then we were up 13 because of Musaf and Shalosh Shodesh. The Chok Chinuyim Shiyesh the Enkelokeinu. The Enkelokeinu now provides the missing 20 brachos. How do you get the missing 20 brachos? So basically there are 5 stanzas of Enkelokeinu. Enkelokeinu, Nikelokeinu, Nozelelokeinu, Baruch Elokeinu, Atahu Elokeinu. Each of those 5 stanzas has 4 phrases associated with that stanza. Ein kelokeinu, ein kadoneinu, ein kemalkeinu, ein kemoshienu. And then again, michelokeinu, michadoneinu, michemalkeinu, michemoshienu. Right? So, again, if I bring out the smartboard, right? So it's 5 stanzas, 4 phrases per stanza, carry the 4, right? It comes out to be a grand total of 20. Altogether, so Ein Kelokeinu now has provided the 20 missing brachas, and now we can rest assured that the 100 brachas of Shabbos have been completed, even though we lost out on all of those, all of those brachas that were missing from the transition from the weekday Shemoneh Esrei to the Shabbos Shemoneh Esrei. So writes the Kolbo. Now, just to analyze this Kolbo for a minute, so first of all, from the Kolbo, it's clear that Ein Kelokeinu's recitation only makes sense for Shabbos and Yom Tov, right? In other words, this is the old Ashkenazi practice. The whole rationale for saying Ein Kelokeinu is to somehow make up what you're missing on Shabbos. So the notion of saying Ein Kelokeinu, you know, during the weekdays, according to the Kolbo, which does simply not make any sense whatsoever. The Kolbo is clearly working with the old, what we today outside of Eretz Yisrael observe as Ashkenazi practice, again, as opposed to the Israeli Ashkenazi practice and as opposed to the Sephardic practice all over the place that says Ein Kelokeinu every day. The Kolbo is clearly assuming that it's a recitation whose whole purpose was, you know, instituted for Shabbos. The commentary in the Ozer HaTfilos Siddur, which was printed, I believe, in Bialystok, actually, as it happens, in the end of the 19th century, one of the classic, more recent Daisha's commentaries on the Siddur, points out, as we said before, that the whole calculation of the Kolbo assumes that a weekday Shemoneh Esrei is only 18 brachos. And of course, right, in other words, again, I don't know if we have to go through the whole math again, but he's assuming, 33 missing brachos. It really should be 36 missing brachos. What do you mean 33 missing brachos? So he suggests the following. The truth is, it seems like there was a divergence of practice going back to Talmudic times as to how many brachos were in Shemoneh Esrei. we're familiar with the story, the way it's told in the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, that the Shemoneh Esrei was originally 18 brachas, and during a period of time after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, there was a feeling that they had to institute an additional bracha against informers who tried to undermine the Jewish people. So they added a 19th bracha, which we refer to as V'lam al-Shinim. And then they went from 18 to 19. That's the way the Babylonian Talmud tells the story. There's a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, in the Yerushalmi, that expresses things a little bit different, and we have ancient manuscripts going back to, you know, the Talmudic period in Eretz Yisrael that seem to indicate that in Eretz Yisrael they only had 18 brachos. Why do they only have 18 brachos? Because the two brachos of the Yerushalayim Ircha and a Semach David were combined into one bracha. And if you think about it, the theme of those two brachos is very similar to one another. The Yerushalayim Ircha Berachamim Tashuv. Let's, you know, God take us back, restore us to Yerushalayim. And then the next bracha is a Semach David Avducha Meheiros Atzmiach. Right? May you cause the Davidic dynasty to be restored. You know, going back to Yerushalayim and the restoration of the Davidic dynasty are, you know, very, very similar concepts. Apparently, the old minhag in Eretz Yisrael was that they would say these two brachas as one. They were combined into one bracha. So even though they had the Lam al-Shinim, even with the Lam al-Shinim, there were only 18 brachas. There's a little bit of a remnant where you can still see today a residue of this practice. I mean, again, clearly this practice of combining the Yerushalayim Ircha and a Semach David is not practiced by anybody today at all. In other words, Ashkenaz, Sfarad, you know, everybody, you know, has those two brachas, those two separate brachas, but a little bit of a remnant of this old practice you can see if you look at the special poems that are added in some shuls, including our own, on Purim morning. On Purim morning, there's something called the Krovets, which is at the end of each bracha and the repetition of Shemoneh Esrei. The Chazan recites a few poetic lines that have to do with Purim in some way or another. And I grew up, we didn't say it in shul, but here in the Lower East Side, I think every shul pretty much says it, if I'm not mistaken. If you go to shul Purim morning, at the end of every stanza, at the end of every bracha on the Shemoneh Esrei, the Chazan inserts a little few lines of poetry that have to do with Purim. So there's a line, there's a poetic line, yeah, the Krovets for Purim, yeah, that's right, exactly. In the Artful Hebrew Only Siddur, it is page 369, okay, there you have it. So, okay, now you heard of it, right? Okay. Right, yeah, it's, now you know. So, if you look in the Krovets for Purim, there is a line for every bracha, except for Es Semach David Avdecha. So it's very striking that, you know, there would be one bracha that wouldn't have a line of poetry for it. So there are other explanations, but one of the explanations is that the Krovets was composed for the old version of Shemoneh Esrei, the way it was recited in Eretz Yisrael, where Yerushalayim Ircha and Es Semach David were one bracha. And if it was one bracha, you only needed to have one line of, you know, one poetic insertion. They didn't have a notion of having two poetic insertions, one for each bracha. So the Krovets for Purim is the last remnant or vestige that we have of this old Eretz Yisraelic custom, which again has fallen by the wayside. But theorizes the author of the Otzar HaTfilos, maybe Ein Kel Elokeinu was really composed in Eretz Yisrael, and it was really composed at a time where the weekday Shemoneh Esrei in Eretz Yisrael was only 18 brachos, not 19 brachos, because that was the old Israeli custom. And, you know, that's reflected in the fact they were trying to make up a missing 33 brachos as opposed to a missing 36 brachos. If that theory is correct, what it tells us is that Ein Kel Elokeinu is really very old, because it's been a very long time in Jewish history since anyone has recited Shemoneh Esrei during the weekday, putting together the Yerushalayim Ircha and Es Semach David Avdecha into one bracha. Right? So it would indicate, if this is all theory is correct, it's a theory, okay, you know, so take it for whatever it's worth, but if the theory is correct, it would indicate that Enkel HaKein was pretty old. Yeah.
So this is a careful problem when you put Eskalach and Yisrael, because they have, otherwise they would have sent them.
Right, so maybe it could be what they did. Again, it's not clear, but it could be what they did is that when they made Vilat Malshinim, they, you know, as opposed to saying, oh well, it's Shmon Esrei, but now we have 19 brachos, so much for that, the approach in Eretz Yisrael was to say, well, we want to maintain the number 18, so if we're going to add Vilat Malshinim, we're going to have to reduce the number of brachos otherwise, so we'll put two brachos together. That could be what went on. What's that? Right. So the text of the bracha when the Beis Hamikdash stood was probably different. I mean, again, Shemach David was relevant even during the second Beis Hamikdash period because they did not have a Davidic dynasty. The Yerushalayim Yerachav Yerachamim Tosho probably was expressed in such a way to ask for the full restoration of everything in the Beis HaMikdash. Remember, the second Beis HaMikdash lacked certain elements that were present in the first Beis HaMikdash, so, and we don't know, but, you know, maybe the text of the Bracha was modified slightly in such a way that, you know, it was asking for the full restoration of everything that was there. In any case, so this explanation of the Kolbo identifies Ein Kel Elokeinu as a way of making up brachos. So you're asking the follow-up question, wait a minute, but it doesn't look like a bracha. Right? A bracha is Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, right? And then fill in some variable after that formula, right? Ein Kel Elokeinu, how is that a bracha? So the Kolbo goes on to point out that if you look at the acrostic that's formed by the stanzas of Ein Kel Elokeinu, we have Ein, we have Mi, we have Noda. So the first letters of Ein, Mi, and Noda spell out our name. Then we have Baruch, and then we have Atahu. So in a certain sense, Ein Kel Elokeinu spells out Amen, Baruch, Atah. So it's not quite a bracha, but at least there's a semblance in some way of the normal formula that we associate with brachas, and maybe for the purposes of mea brachos, in other words, you know, what qualifies for a bracha, for the purposes of having 100 brachas every day, you know, maybe this is considered enough. You know, it's a praise of God, which is really what, in the end of the day, Meir Brach, you know, the idea of saying 100 brachos, it's all about praising God in 100 different ways. Okay, so it's good enough, you know, it meets that bar for being able to be a way of praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, as to fit into the 100. So that's, you know, we often don't think of it because it's not always spelled out in the Siddurim, but essentially when we're saying Ein Kel Elokeinu, we're repeating the idea, Amen Baruch Atah, you know, we're kind of capturing at least a little bit of the framework of what a bracha is all about. According to this explanation of the Kolbo, Ein Kel Elokeinu doesn't really necessarily have anything to do with Pitum HaKetores, which certainly in our Siddurim always follows Ein Kel Elokeinu. Nonetheless, we know that the Siddurim always put Ein Kel Elokeinu and Pitum HaKetores together, and therefore I think it behooves us to take a couple of moments, first of all, to focus on Pitum HaKetores itself, and then to try to understand the relationship between Ein Kel Elokeinu and Pitum HaKetores. If you ask the average shul goer, Pitum HaKetores is that thing that everybody mumbles after we sang Ein Kel Elokeinu. Right? That's probably what the average shul goer knows about Pitum HaKetores. If somebody had come up with a nice tune for Pitum HaKetores, maybe we'd know it a little bit better, but, you know, so far the only really, you know, Ein Kel Elokeinu lends itself to singing a little bit better than Pitum HaKetores. Well, let's talk a little bit though about Pitum HaKetores. Pitum HaKetores essentially is a passage that appears in the Gemara in Krisus, and it describes the composition of the Ketores, of the incense, which, when the Beis HaMikdash stood, was offered up twice a day. It's important to note, and we'll see this a little bit later on, the Ketores plays two roles in the Beis HaMikdash. First of all, on a daily basis, Tores was offered up, the incense was offered up in the morning and then in the very, very late afternoon on a daily basis. Additionally, on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, the highlight of the service on Yom Kippur was that the Kohen Gadol would take incense, bring it into the Kodesh HaKodashim, into the Holy of Holies, and he would, you know, add the incense to coals in such a way so that the entire chamber of the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodashim, would be filled up with smoke. That was, you know, the highlight of the Yom Kippur service, and that's where only the Kohen Gadol was only allowed to go, and only once a year, you know, he went into the Kodesh HaKodashim. That's basically what he was doing. You know, he was bringing incense in the Kodesh HaKodashim, right? So our recitation of Pitum HaKtaras on a daily basis is supposed to parallel not what was done, that which was done on Yom Kippur, but rather it's supposed to parallel the idea that, you know, the incense was offered up twice a day in the Beis HaMikdash itself. What was the role of the incense? So the Rambam actually writes in Marim Avuchim that the incense played a very, very practical role. And if you think about this for 2 minutes, you know, the Rambam resonates, I think, you know, very, very simply. What did it smell like to be in the Beis HaMikdash on a daily basis? Right. I mean, it's probably, you know, we have these romantic images of the Beis HaMikdash and all of that, and of course, you know, the Beis HaMikdash was a place of tremendous holiness. But on the simple level, to walk into the Beis HaMikdash on a daily basis, it smelled like you were in a slaughterhouse. You know why it smelled like you were in a slaughterhouse? Because you were in a slaughterhouse. I mean, that's basically what's going on. You know, they're slaughtering animals left and right, and burning animals on an altar. I mean, you know, it's. And no, it's all going to be there when Mashiach comes also. So, okay, you know, so it's beautiful, and we can talk about, you know, the significance of the karbanos and all of that. But you know what? I mean, on a very, very simple level, it was probably like an overpowering smell to walk into the Beis HaMikdash. The Rambam writes in Marim Avuchim. So, okay, so you needed to have an air freshener. How do you have an air freshener? They brought Kitaris, and the Gemara tells us the Kitaris was incredibly powerful. The Gemara tells us, actually, that the goats in the vicinity of Jericho, of Jericho, now again, think of the map of Eretz itself, Jerusalem to Jericho is not right next door, right? The goats in the vicinity of Jericho used to sneeze from the scent of the Kataras that wafted from the Beis HaMikdash all the way to Jericho, right? So, again, it was obviously, it was a very, very powerful scent. Says the Rambam in Marim Avuchim, you needed a powerful scent just to, you know, to be able to walk around in the Beis HaMikdash and not say, oh my gosh, you know, this smells like a slaughterhouse over here. Right? So on the simplest of levels, that's the Kataras. The Kataras, however, you know, beyond that, has a tremendous, how should we say, there's a tremendous love and a tremendous significance associated with the Kataras. To try to understand that a little bit, I mean, we find in Chumash, for instance, in Sefer Bamidbar, that when a plague breaks out among the Jewish people, the way the plague is stopped is that Aaron HaKohen takes a censer of kitaras, of incense, and magically is able to stop the plague based on his incense. Right? So, again, we don't fully understand what that's all about, but it shows us that the incense is considered to be an extremely powerful, you know, karban, extremely powerful sacrifice, perhaps even more so than other karbanos. So what is it about the incense that's so special? I mean, again, if it's just an air freshener, so what's, you know, it must be something more than that. It was one. It was one. There were 11 spices. Out of the 11 spices, one of them had a bad smell. Right. Right, but in terms of, you know, that one bad smelling spice was 1/11th of the mixture. So apparently the sum total smelled nice. I mean, right. So I mean, the Gemara says that, you know, when the Jewish people are fasting to get, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to respond to us, we have to include sinners in the fast as well. Right? Now, so if we don't have sinners together with us, we're not really a community. Right? That's why you have to go out and tell somebody, you know, you're so good a person. Go out and sin. No, that's probably not the lesson we're supposed to take away from this, right? But the Gemara says, and we learned it from the Ketores, from the incense, because again, the Kelbanah, one of the spices of the incense, apparently spelled bad. And yet we included it in the Ketores. If you don't include it in the Ketores and the incense itself is no good. So that teaches us that whenever the Jewish community bands together to, you know, supplicate God and to ask Him to rescind some terrible decree, we always have to include the sinners among us as well. We can't, you know, be exclusive in that way. Everybody has to play a role. But again, I assume in practical terms, as bad smelling as the Chelbanah was, it probably wasn't overpowering, because then that would sort of, according to the Rambam, that really defeat the purpose of what the Ketores was all about. The Kli Yakar, in his commentary on the Chumash, makes the following beautiful observation about the Ketores, and I think we can take this idea and run with it as we go through the Shiur today. The Kli Yakar writes that we know that most of the sacrifices which were offered up in the Beis HaMikdash were animal sacrifices, and they were offered on the outer altar that was in the Beis HaMikdash. The outer altar, the altar that was used most of the time, was in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. In contrast, the incense was offered on the inner altar, the Mizbeach HaTnimi, which was in the actual building of the Beis HaMikdash. It wasn't in the open-air courtyard, it was in the actual building of the Beis HaMikdash itself. So that's also striking. You know, the incense deserves its own altar, which is actually further inward. You know, it's in the building of the Beis HaMikdash as opposed to being in the outer air courtyard. So says the Kli Yakar, this is supposed to represent the following. When we offer animal sacrifices before God, we're, so to speak, offering our bodies before God. Again, we know that the animal which is sacrificed, we're supposed to view as if it's a substitute for the human being who, you know, in a certain conceptual sense, is being sacrificed on the altar. The Ketores, the incense, as the Kli Yakar, is the equivalent of the person offering up his neshama, his soul, before the Ribono Shel Olam. And of course, you know, the soul is that much more subtle, that much more delicate, that much more spiritual. Right? We know, by the way, that the sense of smell is associated with the spirit in a very, very profound way. So that's why the Ketores, the incense, is offered up not on the outer altar, but on the inner altar, the Zer HaTnimi. And you know, that's why it's considered to be such an elevated type of sacrifice before the Ribono Shel Olam, because, so to speak, we're offering up our soul to God, not merely our body, which is what's represented by the offering of the animal korban. So that's the Pitzum HaKetores. That's the Ketores itself.
So the smell is so strong.
Yeah.
People actually
smell it. No, it's a good smell.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess some of this, you know, you just have to understand in a miraculous fashion, right? In other words, you know, we're going to try to apply the regular laws of physics to the scent, we're going to come up short. Right. I mean, clearly it was something that you could stand, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to stand it, right? So I guess, again, you have to, in the end of the day, you have to invoke the miracle card, you know, that the Ribono Shel Olam made it work in such a way so that it was a pleasant smell in the Beis HaMikdash and even far away from the Beis HaMikdash, and it was something pleasant and not something overpowering. Again, okay? As I said, we'll get there, you know, and we'll see it again.
Yeah.
It includes Pikar. So does that include Enkel Kano?
Why would they have it?
Okay, so let's go forward. Okay, so the Pitzum HaKetores, the prayer itself, delineates the 11 spices of the Ketores, and if you dive it with an article sitter, they do you the nice favor of actually, you know, listing them. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Pitzum HaKetores, you know, the incense mixture was formulated of 11 spices, and then it goes on to list them, all 11. And then it comments at the end, If you eliminate or you leave out one of these spices, you're liable for the death penalty. So what does that mean? So the simple interpretation seems to be that if you're the spice mixer, you'd better take out a pretty good insurance policy. Because, you know, if you're having a bad day, and the Gemara says that there was a certain family that was involved with Beis HaMikdash, the family of Aftinas, and they had the specialty. They knew how to make the incense. Nobody else really knew how to make the incense. But if somebody woke up and they had a bad day, and you put in 10 spices as opposed to 11 spices, that's it. You know, boom, zap, you know, you're done with. And, you know, you're subject to some kind of heavenly decree of death. Right. Oh, okay, okay. All right, well, yeah. Sure, we'll go for this. Right. Okay. Okay, yeah, so hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll elaborate on that in just a minute, right? So, again, it's a little bit of a scary thing. I mean, it sounds like on the surface level, that, you know, if you're preparing the taras and you leave out one of the ingredients, that's it. You know, you're subject to some kind of, you know, heavenly death, which clearly is not something that anybody wants to do. Following up on that, you find the following statement from Rabbi Yitzchak Abuhov. If you go to Tzfas today, you see one of the many shuls, the old shuls that are in Tzfas, is the shul of the Mahari Abuhav. And Rav Yitzchak Abuhav was in Tzfas, was part of that group that were, you know, involved in the study of Kabbalah in particular. So the Mahari Abuhav writes, Ein lo ma'atitim haktores, elo mitol haktav. You better be careful to read Pitzum HaKtores when you do so out of a sitter. Why? Because if you say it by heart, you might eliminate one of the ingredients. And the same way that the person who brings, who prepares the actual Ktores is liable to the death penalty if he eliminates one of the ingredients, if you read it and you miss one of the ingredients, you're reading it a little bit too fast, boom, it's curtains. Right? So you better read it out of the sitter, says the Mahari Abuhav, because we don't want bad things happening. V'ulai shemizeh hatam ein omrim oso b'miksas mekomos hafopisha omrim parshas hakorbonos. And says the Mahari Abuhav, it's maybe for this reason that there are some places who eliminate the recitation of Pitzum HaKtores altogether. Right. Right, because, you know, if you're going to only list off 10 ingredients, better not to say it. You know, why put yourself at risk? You know, just, and he says that's the reason that you have some places who don't say it altogether. Speaking a little bit later in history, the Ramah of Moshe Isserles, who lived in Krakow in the 1500s and is really the source for most Ashkenazi practice, he writes, Haminog be'elu hamedinos, the practice in these countries, in the Ashkenazi countries, is kedivrei Mahari Abuhav. We follow this position of the Mahari Abuhav. Shelo la'omro b'chol. And that's why we don't say Pitzum HaKtores during the week, and the custom of the Ramah as well was that even when they said korbanos in the morning, or for that matter korbanos, you know, for that matter when they would daven mincha, they would not recite Pitzum HaKtores. Pitzum HaKtores was something that was restricted to Shabbos. Bishum shetrudin lemalachtam, because everybody's rushing through davening during the week. They want to get out and catch the train to wherever they need to go for work. Even then, things don't change. V'yesh lachush. She's al gubo, and we're concerned that if you say Pitzum HaKtores during the week, you'll say it fast, you'll only hit 8 out of the 11 ingredients, and boom, you know, that's it. You know, the person who's reading Pitzum HaKtores incorrectly is going to be chayiv misa, is going to be subject to a divine punishment. Uveshabbos v'yom tov omrim also. So therefore, says the Rambam, our practice is to only recite Tefillin HaKtoras on Shabbos and Yom Tov, because we assume that people are davening a little bit slower, and people will actually take the time to read Tefillin HaKtoras properly from the Siddur, say all the words. If we were to institute the recitation of Tefillin HaKtoras during the week, how can they, you know, would be very, very concerned that people would, you know, miss one of the words and they'd be subject to the death penalty. What's that? Yeah, I guess, you know. I guess. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a scary thing. So that's, again, we go to, you know, we started off the discussion earlier talking about the custom of Nusach Ashkenaz to only recite Ein Elokeinu and Pita Ma'aktaras on Shabbos, not during the week. We already addressed, according to the Kolbo, why Ein Elokeinu would be restricted to Shabbos. The whole point of it was to make up the missing brachos that you had on Shabbos. And the idea of limiting Pita Ma'aktaras to Shabbos, which on the surface doesn't make sense, because they brought the Ktaras, they brought the incense every single day that they come into us. But this concern of dropping one of the ingredients was apparently such a strong concern among the early Ashkenazi communities that they said, okay, we're just going to say it on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we're not going to risk saying it during the course of the week. Yeah. The chlau, or altogether. Yeah.
I'm
going,
why? I always say it,
right? You
know, it's part of
bonding.
And she said, no, because I made a lot of rent, and I asked her, and she said, for
that reason. So I'm Shabbos also. Yes. Right.
So I skipped it, and I
started
last year, you know.
Interesting.
And he said, not
to say. That's very interesting.
Yeah, so, but now, like,
I
can't. I remember, like, a year ago from her, that I went in later, and I'm, like, saying, why? And she's saying,
right.
Better
not to say it altogether, even on Shabbos. Interesting.
Very, very interesting.
Right. 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 Very interesting. That's very, very interesting. Okay, yeah. Right, so the traditional Nusach Ashkenaz was not to say it in Korbanos in the morning either. And they still do that. If you go to Breuer's in Washington Heights, in Kaldas Yeshurim, so, you know, Korbanos, they do recite Korbanos in the morning, but they do not say Pita Machtaris as part of Korbanos. That all goes back to the minute of the Ramah, that, you know, we're afraid to say Pita Machtaris because we're afraid to miss one of the words. And it's interesting, on this idea that comes from the Maria Abuov, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Beis Yosef, who subsequently authored the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef comments on the Maria Abuov that in Halacha Nekabel, okay, if that's the tradition, I guess we accept it. V'im aval im l'din yesh tshuva. But if it's just the Maria Abuov, not, you know, just offering his own opinion, in other words, he's not reflecting some kind of ancient tradition, to only say Pitzim HaKtoras on Shabbos, says the Beis Yosef, I don't think that's correct. And he goes on to explain how the idea that if you, you know, the idea that first of all, if you were to miss saying one of the ingredients, you'd be high of nisa, you'd be subject to the death penalty, seems very odd. I mean, that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara talks about, you know, eliminating one of the ingredients in actuality, not about, you know, not reading one of the ingredients, because you didn't read one of the ingredients, you're going to be high of nisa. And then he also goes on to say that if you look in the commentaries, particularly Rashi and that Gemara, they explain the Gemara differently. They say the Gemara is talking about, first of all, Yom Kippur. What the Gemara means to say is as follows. If the Kohen Gadol were to enter the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies, on Yom Kippur, with an incense mixture that had been prepared incorrectly, so then he'd be Chayiv Nisa. He'd be subject to the death penalty. Why? Not because he eliminated the ingredient from the ksaris, from the incense, but because he went into the Kodesh HaKodashim in a way in which he can't carry out his duties properly. Right, in other words, you know, if It's already pushing it, pushing the envelope to allow the Kohen Gadol to go into the Kodesh HaKodashim altogether. Right? If you're going to go in prepared. If you go, what would happen, let's say, if the Kohen Gadol were just to decide on Yom Kippur? You know what? I feel like going to the Kodesh HaKodashim right about now. Not to do anything, just to chill, to hang out, right? So yeah, he'd be subject to the death penalty for going into the Kodesh HaKodashim. So by the same token, explains Rashi, if he goes into the Kodesh HaKodashim on Yom Kippur with an incomplete Ketaris, a Ketaris which hasn't been prepared properly, he's subject to the death penalty for having trespassed on the Kodesh HaKodashim without being properly prepared. It has nothing to do with the fact that the incense per se wasn't prepared properly. So as the Beis Yosef says, the author of the Shulchan Aruch is unimpressed by this argument of the Ma'ariv Abuav. Now, and basically dismisses it. And let's carry this over to actual practice. Right? The author of the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, was the primary posek for Sephardic Jews, and even the Hasidic Nusach Sfard drew much from the positions of Rav Yosef Karo. So it's not so surprising that Nusach Sfard says Enkel Okeinu and Pitum HaKtoris every day, because this concern that, oh, we'll skip one of the ingredients was sort of dismissed by Rav Yosef Karo. You know, he didn't think that that was a significant concern. So, okay, so Sfard accepts that and says Pitum HaKtoris on a daily basis, because why not? The Ktoris in the Beis HaMikdash was brought on a daily basis. Why not recite, you know, the passage that corresponds to the Ktoris on a daily basis? Nusach Ashkenaz in Eretz Yisrael was primarily impacted upon by the Vilna Gaon. You know, the students of the Vilna Gaon in the beginning of the 1800s were among the first Ashkenazim to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. And when they established shuls in Eretz Yisrael, they established them to daven Nusach Ashkenaz. But daven Nusach Ashkenaz was a particular viewpoint and the opinions that were associated with the Vilna Gaon. It's interesting, you know, the old, if you go to Eretz Yisrael today, you see, you know, people who describe themselves as Yerushalmim, right? They wear colorful bekishes and they wear shtreimel. They're not Hasidim. Right? Those are actually the descendants of the students of the Vilna Gaon, who back in the day were referred to as the Prushim, the separatists. You know, they kind of held themselves apart from much of the rest of the Jewish community, and they had that lavush, they had that particular way of dressing with the shreimlach and the colorful bekishes. They're not Hasidim. The old Yerushalmis, they're all, you know, students of the or descendants of students of the Vilna Gaon. So they instituted the Nusach Ashkenaz, which we know today in Eretz Yisrael. The Vilna Gaon was also unimpressed by this argument of the Ma'ariv Abuav, oh, you're going to miss a word, you're going to be subject to the death penalty. Nah, come on, that's not really a concern. So the students of the Vilna Gaon would also recite Ein Kel Okeinu and Pitum HaKtoris on a, right, an Israeli Seder. They say it every day at the end of davening, right, because that was the position of the Vilna Gaon. So, you know, these different practices that we have today are all ultimately a response that took place in the 1500s mostly to this question, are we concerned about somehow skipping a word or two in the Pitum HaKtoris? Does that, you know, phase us? You know, the classic Ashkenazi response was yes, we are concerned about that. The classic Sephardi response and the response of the Vilna Gaon was no, we're not really so concerned about that. So why not say Pitum HaKtoris on a daily basis? Let's just explain one last thing, which I think is just a very, very beautiful idea, and we'll try to wrap it up with this. So, what's the connection then between Enkel Okeinu and Pitum HaKtoris? Again, we saw before that Enkel Okeinu, according to the Kol, goes away making up the 100 brachas on Shabbos, but clearly, once you're going to start saying Enkel Okeinu on a daily basis with Pitum HaKtoris, which is the practice of Nusach Sfard, and the practice of the Vilna Gaon and his students, clearly you're saying that Ein Kel Okeinu is not just a Shabbos thing, it has relevance to Pitum HaKtoris on a daily basis. And last sentence, after who Shikir Abu Senu Chonasas Ktaris HaSamim, right, you God are the one before whom our ancestors brought the incense, clearly is linking the Ein Kel Okeinu to Pitum HaKtoris. So how does that work? So the other Yehuda, Rabbi Chesko Landau, who was the Rav of Prague in the 1700s, offers the following very, very beautiful explanation. He says, if you look at the Gemara, we find that the Kohen who brought the Ksores became rich. And in fact, the Gemara says, as a result, that, you know, they would have a lottery every day to determine which Kohen would have the privilege of bringing the Ksores on a daily basis. You could only sign up once. In other words, once you were picked to bring the Ksores, they disqualified you from participating in the lottery going forward. Why? Give the other guys a chance. What, you know, what, you're going to become rich twice? Right? No, you know, if you go, you become rich. They say, by the way, that a similar kind of idea applies to somebody who's handed at a bris. They say that that's supposed to be, you know, a good sign for the person who's tzaddik at a bris, who holds the baby, you know, to become rich. So that's why it's such a coveted position to be the tzaddik at a bris, right? So I think they say to Rav Soloveitchik that people once, they ask them, yeah, but it doesn't always seem to work. You know, I mean, people become tzaddik and, you know, they don't seem to become rich afterwards. What's that? Well, the truth is, we're careful. The only time we let a tzaddik do more than once is like a big rav or a rosh yeshiva or the like, who's considered to be the equivalent of the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol could repeat bringing the Taurus as much as he wanted. For the average person, in other words, the average person is supposed to take tzaddik once and then not repeat it over again. I think if they really once, I mean, again, if there's nobody else, it's not like, okay, don't do the bris, we don't have a tzaddik. But all things being equal, you know, you're supposed to try to literally share the wealth. So once they're supposed to eventually, supposedly, you know, people are tzaddik and, you know, they still seem to have problems, you know, paying off the bills, you know, doesn't work. So Soloveitchik said, you know, wealth is measured in terms of what you consider wealth to be. So Soloveitchik said, I've been tzaddik many, many times. For me, the currency which matters most is Torah. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, by being tzaddik, I feel that I've become wealthy in that particular area. Doesn't mean that I can pay off the bills necessarily, but at least in the area of Torah, I feel that I can pay the bills a little bit, you know, by virtue of paying that off. So the Ksaras is really the main idea of that the Ksaras is supposed to bring about wealth. So says the Nova de Yehuda, so if you're really going to say Pisa Machtaras every day, we really believe that that's somehow equivalent to the actual Ksaras that you brought the Beis HaMikdash, so you know what, by saying Pisa Machtaras on a daily basis, maybe that will make you wealthy. So that's a great thing, right? Well, yes and no. Because when a person becomes wealthy, you may forget the one upstairs. You know, it's very easy to say when you don't have money, so it's easy to daven and ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, help me out. But when you do have money, you know, like the story of the guy who's circling looking for a parking space, he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, please send me a parking space, send me a parking space. Oh, never mind, I found one. Right? So, you know, when a person actually has wealth, they tend to forget the Ribbono Shel Olam. Says another Bihuda, that's why right before Pita Maktaras we start by saying, Ain't Elokeinu, there's nobody like God. Mich Elokeinu, who's like our God? No, Bel Elokeinu, we have to thank the Ribbono Shel Olam and bless him. In other words, even though the recitation of Pita Maktaras may have made you wealthy, right, make sure that it doesn't detract from your also being wise, and realize that Ein Kelokeinu, Ein Kadoneinu, that it's ultimately the Ribbono Shel Olam who bestows wealth or anything, you know, wealth, health, happiness, everything upon the Jewish people, upon the world, and you know, be cognizant of that, you know, even while you're saying Pita Maktaras. So that's the lesson, whether you say Pita Maktaras or not, certainly the lesson of Ein Kelokeinu, that we should recognize that everything comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam, is certainly a lesson worth remembering on Shabbos and every single day, you know, regardless of whether you say Pita Maktaris on a daily basis. Okay, wish everybody a wonderful week. Stay warm. And I think so. Yes, that's our chance.